G. Edward Griffin, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thank you, Andy.
We're saying hello again, and I wanted to reiterate what an honor it is. And I'll tell our audience that 30 years ago, I originally read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and I bought another copy to share with my children. Start from the top here about the creation of the Fed, and really that sets up the whole book and really sets up to where we're at right now. You start out the book about these different bankers and influencers of the time. They got it in train and they were coming to Jekyll Island.
Well, that's where it all began with the Fed, and it's certainly where it all began with my interest in the Fed, because I got involved in this story of money and banking, not because I had any great interest in it as a young guy. I certainly didn't study it in school. I was really the last person on this planet to write a really serious book about money and banking. I knew nothing about it. I had no prior interest in it. But I was concerned about what was happening in the world. And I was out there, tootling around trying to inform people that things weren't necessarily what they thought they were. We better wake up and do something, or we're going to lose all the traditions of our great country and all that. And so I was producing a series of very low budget documentary films. And I wanted to do a film on inflation. And so that's what triggered me off in that direction. So I started to do some research on inflation, and I gathered a couple of banker boxes full of books and articles and notes and all kinds of documents from various sources, some recordings. I never did produce the film. It was a gigantic topic for me, and I recognized it right soon that it was beyond really my ability to adequately handle. So I put it aside and dealt with easier topics that I felt I could do justice to. But that's what got me interested in this whole topic, because I wanted to do a documentary film, which scared the heck out of me because I realized how little I knew, how much I had to learn. Well, to fast forward on this, about a year later, there was a group in Pasadena. I started to say little old ladies in Pasadena. That is exactly what they were. This lady that contacted me, her husband had been quite wealthy. He passed away and left a pretty good fortune. She lived in a great house in Pasadena, had one of these very expensive cars in the garage, was a collectible, probably had about 50 miles on it. And anyway, she was a delightful lady. And she had a class or a meeting every month on taxes. And she invited me to speak before her group on taxes. And I said, I don't know anything about taxes except that they're too high and I don't like them. So what else can I say? That's the story of taxation. But I said, I could possibly talk to your group about a hidden tax. And she said, oh, a hidden tax. That sounds good. What is that? So cunningly, I said to her, well, I guess you're just going to have to retain me to deliver the speech to find out what it is. Of course, I was talking about inflation. So that sent me back to those banker boxes full of documents. And that time when I went through it, I'd learned a lot more about what was going on in the world. And I realized that what I was reading in those banker boxes and those documents, which had frightened me at first, intrigued me immensely more than they did, because I knew more about how important the role was played by the banking fraternity and how it controlled politics and society, culture, everything else. Education stemmed from this banking cartel. So I took a real strong interest in it, and I cobbled together a speech for the little old ladies in Pasadena, and it was well received, and I was encouraged to put it on the road, which I did. I prepared a one-day seminar called A Crash Course on Money, and I put it on the road, and it went pretty well. It was very well received. We went from city to city and pretty well packed the hotel rooms with them, and I felt good that I was delivering some information. Well, I just had my nose under the tent even then, even though I was supposedly an expert. An expert is somebody that knows two things more than you do. And it wasn't hard for anyone to know at least two things more about the Fed than anybody else because people don't know anything about the Fed. So I was feeling pretty puffy. I think I was doing a good job. I don't know if this interests you or not, but this is how I got into all of that. And at the end of one of my seminars, another little old lady, not from Pasadena, but probably from Cincinnati, I was in the Midwest someplace, approached me and she said, "What do you recommend I do with my investments?" She said, "My husband passed away and I have a small amount of money and we're invested now in my children and I are invested in an apartment building, small apartment building, and we're deeply in debt. Now, I'm worried about being in debt, having listened to what you said. Should I get out of debt? Should I borrow more money and go get more apartment buildings? What should I do? Should I invest in gold and silver, something tangible like that?" And I was dumbfounded. I realized at that moment that I was kind of a fraud because she really thought I knew the answer to that question. And I didn't. I had no idea. I knew about banking by this time. I knew how they created money out of nothing or created out more specifically out of debt. And I knew about the scam of banking, but I had no idea about the real world of finance and investments. So I quit doing the seminar and I enrolled in the College for Financial Planning in Denver. And I eventually got my CFP degree in financial planning, not because I wanted to be a financial planner, but because I wanted to know about the real world of markets so I could answer that lady's question. And I came out of the other end of that with a stunning realization that everything they were teaching in this, not everything, but almost everything of importance they were teaching financial planners was bunk. It was bunk in terms of the real world because it did not take into account the scam of banking and the depreciation of money and the long-range loss of purchasing power and all of those things. Had no recognition of that fact. And I said to myself, somebody's got to write a book on this thing. And so that's how I sort of was drawn into it. And I still at that time, I was the last person in the world that should do it, but nobody else had done it. Not that there weren't books written about the Federal Reserve, but most of them were kind of technical. They were how to be a banker or something like that. You know, what do deposits mean? What's a term deposit versus a demand deposit? What's the discount rate? What does that mean? All these technical things. And it's pretty boring unless you're intending to make a business and a livelihood out of it. So none of the books really grabbed hold of the topic as I saw it at this time. Because as I saw it, and now we're going to get around to your question, the answer to your question, what is the Federal Reserve? I saw that what I had been learning was a story. It was not a story about banking and money so much as it was a whodunit. It was a story of a crime, a huge crime. And I thought that people wanted or needed to know that a crime had been committed, a huge crime of proportions greater than almost anything the world had ever seen, a crime involving legalized plunder. And I thought they ought to know who committed the crime, how they did it, and where the body was buried, and so forth. So I approached the whole topic from that point of view that this is a crime. Let's find out what it was and who did it. Now that takes us to Jekyll Island. Why is Jekyll Island significant with this big, boring story I just told you? Is because the whole reason these people were there on Jekyll Island is because they wanted to create this thing called the Federal Reserve in secret. They didn't want anybody prying into their meetings. They didn't want to do it in Washington, D.C. They didn't want to do it in Chicago or New York, where all the reporters were. So they went to this island, Jekyll Island, off the coast of Georgia, as you know. And there, some of the wealthiest bankers and industrialists had their summer resorts. They usually called them cottages.
They still did.
14-room cottages and 7 or 8 bathrooms and all that sort of thing. But they went there because they had a clubhouse that was open only to the super wealthy, the Jekyll Island Club. And these people were members of it or friends of members. So they went to this clubhouse on Jekyll Island, away from the prying eyes of reporters or other people in the banking business, to create the Federal Reserve in secret. And they went to great lengths to make it secret. And I discovered that the things they did were of the level that you would expect to be done in the event of planning a surprise attack against the enemy. It was extreme secrecy. They used code names for each other. Even after they got on this private train in New Jersey that was going to take them from New Jersey to Jekyll Island, once they got on board, first of all, they were told to arrive separately, not to come together, not to be seen together, to avoid reporters and all that kind of stuff. One of them even brought a big black shotgun case with him in case some reporter, which usually the reporters hung out there at the train station because important people always entered and exited New York through the New Jersey station there. And he was prepared that if somebody should ask him, where are you going, sir? He could have said, I'm going on a duck hunting trip. But we find out later from one of his biographers who was quoting one of his children that this fellow never fired a gun in his life. He borrowed the gun and the gun case just for show to have an excuse for being on that train and should he be noticed to be among a few others who also were supposedly going on a duck hunting trip. And when they even got on the private railroad car, which was owned by one of these chaps, they were told to address each other in code names, to use first names only, especially, and never use a last name. And two of them even adopted code names to speak each other. One was the Wright brothers. They played with the word Wright, and that was because they thought that they were always right on the topic, and it was kind of a little joke, but it was a code name nevertheless. And the servants didn't know who these people were, and the servants were told not to talk about it. When they got to Jekyll Island for the clubhouse, most of the servants that normally would be there to serve the normal members had been dismissed for the week, and they were replaced by temporary people who had no idea who these people are. I could go on and on, but when I realized all this secrecy now, I began to realize that, you know, when people do things in secret, there's usually something to hide. So that's what caught my attention. What is it that they were trying to hide? And so that's how I got into it with that whole point. And I thought, because of its ability to attract my interest, I thought I would put that forward in my own book. What is it they were trying to hide? And that's, I think, probably the main reason that my book, surprisingly, it turned out to be very popular. I didn't think anybody would ever read the book, but it went like hotcakes. I think it's because I approached it from that crime point of view rather than a technical point of view. Now, I don't know if that really touches on what you wanted to get out of it, but that's how I got into it. Yeah, that's what caught my attention. And of course, from that point forward, it just got worse. I mean, I discovered that the crime was bigger and more heinous than I even knew at that time. And even today, I discover things about it that I didn't realize. It's a humongous crime.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's exactly what I wanted. And if you don't mind, if we can delve into a little bit about that. And you see me looking down, I'm taking notes just about the next question because you've piqued my curiosity. And I think it's so important to get out there. How did they create money from nothing, if you can expand on that just for our audience and our listeners?
Well, yes, that's a huge topic, but it doesn't need to be necessarily huge. The principles are pretty simple. They had to convert money away from what it was to a new concept. Now, what it was not pure at the time the Federal Reserve System was created. It had already been tampered with. But basically, it was a system in which money, paper money, and that's what we're really talking about, was representative of something of value other than the paper itself. There was supposed to be something behind the paper that you could exchange your paper for, and that something was gold or silver. That's the way monetary systems were at the turn of the last century, and it proved itself to be an adequate test of money because it gave assurance to the money holder that he wasn't going to be cheated in some way. He could, as long as he could exchange that little paper, which was a receipt, by the way, like a warehouse receipt, take it back to the warehouse and say, look, I put 10 ounces of gold in this warehouse. You gave me the receipt, and it says on the receipt, it's to the bearer on demand. Well, I'm the bearer, and I'm demanding the gold, so they have to give it to him as a contract. That kind of money is called receipt money, and it's very good money. And in that way, it's pretty hard to cheat a person. You can steal, but you can't cheat so much on the value of the money. And so they had to change that. They had to change it so that there was really nothing behind those receipts after all. And it took a long time to do that. But by the time it came to 1910, and that's when this whole process began, where they had that meeting on Jekyll Island, was in November of 1910, and the Federal Reserve Act was passed in December of 1913. So there was a three-year period in which they were organizing, structuring, and promoting this whole idea. And so they had to create a system that did not depend on hard backing of the currency by gold or silver or anything else that requires human effort to produce. It had to be backed by political decree or banker's decree or something, just some kind of wave of wand. So they could create money out of nothing. Well, the funny thing is that anybody can create money out of nothing, but it's the trick is getting people to accept it. So you have to convince them that, well, the money really does have something behind it, even though it doesn't. So that's really the story of the whole story of banking since that time, is to convince people that this thing we call money is backed by something, backed if not by gold and silver, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, or whatever that is, that kind of faith and credit that is, or something. They think that, well, that's really worth something. So how did they do it? First of all, they wrote the Federal Reserve Act, which gave them the legal authority to issue money based on IOUs, in other words, which are debt. You don't really put up money to get the receipt. You put up a promise to pay it back to get your receipt. Now, that's a promise to pay is not the same as an ounce of gold. It depends on your ability to pay. It depends on the ability and the integrity of the banker to give it to you, because he's the middleman. Maybe the original borrower gives it to the bank, say you give it back to the guy that put up the gold or put up whatever, the property, and the banker says, yes, I'll do that. But if the banker reneges, you still don't get your gold. So you have this third-party risk when you have these promises to do that and contracts to do that. This is third-party risk, they call it. And that's where the problem creeps into the system, third-party risk. And that's the short version. It may not mean much to the average person, but when you just to say it out loud, it sort of explains there's nothing really to back it other than the integrity and honesty of the individuals involved. And even beyond that, you can have very, very righteous people, very honest people, but if the system is rotten, it crumbles underneath them and they can't help themselves. They go down with it as well as you. So in a nutshell, to answer your question, what happens is that, let's say you go into the bank and you want to borrow, let's say you want to borrow $10,000. And the banker looks at you very sternly and he said, well, do you have any assets? Have you any record of being an honest borrower? And he's like, he's really concerned about you. You should be more concerned about him, but he puts on the act. He's concerned about your ability to repay this loan. Well, I can understand that, because your ability to repay the loan is how he makes his living, out of the repayment of the loan plus interest. And that's where the foul play begins to come in, because you're willing to pay interest on money that's loaned to you. You presume that somebody had the money and they made a sacrifice by giving it to you instead of enjoying it themselves, and they want interest on that money. That seems fair, and I think it is fair. But when they didn't have any money to start off with, when they pretended to have money to start off with, you say, I want to borrow $10,000. And the banker will say, well, we can possibly arrange that. And then the borrower, I'm making this up as we go. Supposing you're the borrower and you say, well, you know, I read in the newspaper or I read in this guy's book, Creature from Jekyll Island, that you don't really have any money here in the bank to lend. Is that true? Well, it's not exactly true. It's the theory of banking is that he goes into blah, 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 blah. But in fact, it's true. The bank does not have the money that he's about to loan to you. But he's allowed by the law, which he wrote himself while they were on Jekyll Island and had these idiot congressmen pass it into law. They're allowed by law to loan at least the figures that started off with, at least 9 times more cash than they have. They can multiply their money by 10. And so they only need to keep, say, 10%. By the way, all that is gone by the wayside too. I don't think they keep any reserves anymore. But for the longest time of its existence, the Federal Reserve did have a reserve requirement. They had to keep generally, depending on the type of bank and so forth, but generally about 10% had to be a real reserve. And that's why the system sometimes is called fractional reserve banking, because the reserve is just a fraction of what you think it should be. So they'll loan 10 times as much money as they have. And you think, well, how can you? Okay, so you don't really have this money, right?
Well, no.
Yes, no, we do, but we don't. But, well, why should I pay interest on something that you don't have? You're just printing this stuff out for me. He said, well, we'll have you speak with our manager. And so they never want to talk about that. But that's the trick. They create money out of nothing, but it's backed by debt. So it's worse than nothing. It's a requirement that if they, let's say if a farmer hawks his farm to get $50,000 to pay for his mother's operation or something, and he can't pay it back, even though the banker didn't loan him anything that he had, the banker gets the farm. The banker gets the farm. He gets the real asset in exchange for debt. Now, that's the whole system in a nutshell. That's how they do it. They get people into debt. They know that most of those people, or many of them, are not going to repay the debt. They really want them to repay the debt because all the interest is interest on nothing. Not a bad deal. If you can collect interest on nothing, you're in a good business. Now you're in the banking business. And that's sort of an oversimplification of the process. But in principle, it is exactly correct. So that's how they do it. It's a scam. It's a big scam.
You know, you brought up fractional reserve banking, and I was going to ask you, it sounds like that my dad, when I was growing up, my father would tell me about the evils of fractional reserve banking, and which you just hit on. And so that's exactly what it is. We don't really need to address that. If you would, walk me back a little bit further. Where did this come from? Did these guys make it up, this system? When I say these guys, these conspirators or this cabal or a cartel, as you call it, did they make it up on Jekyll Island, or did the roots even go further back in America or even Europe?
Well, it goes way, way back. It certainly goes way back to Europe. It goes back to the Bank of England. It was all of these gimmicks were borrowed pretty much from the Bank of England, which by this time was under the total influence of the Rothschild banking dynasty. It appeared to be the Bank of England, but it was really the Bank of the Rothschilds. And that's another element to this story that makes it seem kind of weird, is that we think of these banks, which have the names of the United States or Bank of England, the Bank of France, and so we may, well, those are government banks, right? Well, maybe technically they are, but in reality, no, they're very private. They're controlled by people who are the managers and stockholders of private banks, and they form partnerships with government entities like Treasury Department and so forth, and they go into contracts, and through these partnership agreements, they become one. And if we think, well, whether the bankers on one side and the government politicians on the other side, it very quickly melds into one big club, and they move back and forth. And that's hard for people to realize, that we're really dealing with a cartel that includes politicians and bankers both. They work together for their mutual advantage. They have different roles in the scheme, in the game, but they work quite together for their mutual advantage. One alone cannot do all of the things that the two of them together can do, because the bankers they're the brains of the thing. They create the mechanisms and the machinery that makes it work, and the governments make it legal and they enforce it so that you and I have to obey it. So those two have to go together, otherwise it falls apart.
It's interesting to me, you said that this started in 1910 here in the States, if you would, or that's when they hatched the plan. And then World War II, or not World War II, but World War I started shortly after. And I guess my question is, that would be a great way to fund a war. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It's the best way to fund a war, if you want to fight a war just for the sake of fighting a war. Now, that brings up a big question. Why do people fight wars? Well, nobody in their right mind, no citizen would ever want to start a war. But politicians and leaders do. Why is that? How come men on the street and women on the street never think, it would be nice if we could have a war, you know? But the guys in charge are always coming up with this idea. Now, if it was a defensive war, somebody was attacking you and you had to defend your nation, your property, your home, your family, your own life. Oh, sure. Count me in. I'm in it. I'm all for it. I'm for defense. That's why everybody in a war, whether they're the victim or not, pretend to be the victim. They always have to present their case as they attacked us. They did this. They destroyed us. They lied. They cheated. They killed and so forth. And we have all these false flag things that happen throughout history. We're actually, take Pearl Harbor as a perfect example. The United States government officials knew full well that the Japanese could be egged into an attack against Pearl Harbor. And they made it happen. They cleared all resistance out of the way. They kept insulting, and making it easy for them to strike and so forth. And they knew that the minute the Japanese fleet left their harbor and was steaming on the way to Pearl, they knew all of that, but kept the information away from the admirals and Pearl Harbor and the generals and American admirals and generals. And they sacrificed, 4,000 American sailors' lives. And so they could be victimized. And, oh, this is a day of infamy, says Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was a day of infamy, but he was the one that was responsible for the infamy. But they did that so that we could get into the war, which they wanted to do for political reasons, but come in as the victim rather than as the aggressor. Well, that's the thing without history. I mean, wars are usually waged, and they're started at least by somebody who has an aggressive goal, which is to expand their sphere of influence or to capture the resources, the natural resources of some other nation, or to settle an old account from centuries ago, or who knows what. But none of them are really defensive wars, except for some cases of the people being attacked, of course. But often the leaders of the people being attacked don't play the game that way. They pretend to be attacked when they're actually the forces that attacked them were wearing the enemy's uniform and it was really their own forces. It's a harsh reality when you come across it. But that's a game that's been played for decades, if not centuries. So is that a good way to finance a war? You bet it is, because the politicians have learned over the, I guess, centuries, I would say. I never used to be a historian in any way. I wasn't interested in history until I got into all this, but I've become an avid consumer of history since then. And even though I'm a late comer to the game, it seems to me that of all the history I've read, the people of a nation will tolerate taxation up to about the point of 40% of their what they earn. They'll say, well, all right, it's for the greater good. It's for the nation. I'm patriotic. I'll follow. We've been attacked or whatever it is, And they want all the benefits of the government up to about 40%. And beyond that, there's a rebellion. There's a tax rebellion. And the leaders find that, they're no longer the leaders. Somebody else comes in under the banner of tax reform. We'll reduce the taxes and get rid of the corruption. Of course, they don't do either of those things, but that's how they get into the new position. So the idea of financing a war, if it's going to be more expensive than 40% of the total income of everybody in the nation, it's just not going to work. So if you can finance a war beyond 40% without the people knowing that they're paying the tax, in other words, if you can do it through inflation and the average person doesn't realize that inflation is merely a hidden tax, like the little old ladies in Pasadena learned that day. It was a tax, it's just you didn't realize it. So they prefer to pay for wars and for other means of, payments to their friends and to support foreign governments that will be their allies in war conflicts and so forth, to buy friends and to discipline their enemies. They need money for that. And so if you can do that through a process that nobody understands is a tax, like inflation, then you can blame the farmer and the grocer and the guy at the union worker that's making too much money, That's a much better deal.
Right. Well, let's take this now fast forward. We have the conspiracy, if you would, and I hate to call it conspiracy because of the negative connotation, but the reality of what happened, if you would. And let's fast forward to now. Today's age, well, we have a lot of inflation that's in the news all the time. And not only is it in the news, I mean, I just go down to the grocery store and, eggs used to cost $2 a dozen. I mean, literally just a few years ago. And now, they're $5, $6 a dozen. I just use that as anecdotal evidence. But I guess where exactly in your mind are we at now? Where are we at a tipping point, if you would? I mean, we have high inflation. We have a lot of war. Are people finally waking up and getting tired of this?
Well, I think we are at a tipping point, definitely. And as you just expressed, it's beginning to be visible even to the people who are sound asleep when they start paying three times, four times what they did for eggs and bread. They notice it. And at first, it's kind of funny. Well, did you notice what the price of bread is going high, isn't it? Oh, this is ridiculous. It's sort of almost a fun conversation. But after a while, wait a minute, I can't go to the grocery store. I can't feed my family anymore. And it gets really serious. And so what do I think about that? Well, I think it's becoming obvious. All right, that's true. It's becoming exponential. That's true. And so what does that mean? Does that mean it's going to go on forever, or does it mean it's going to level off and reverse, or what? What I think that means, as the very least, if we use history as an example, it means it's the beginning of the end of a exponential ramp up in which the purchasing power just drops precipitously to the point where nobody can buy even a decent living or a poor living with the wages they earn. And that's when society begins to fall apart. That's when there are riots and public morality goes down, and there are lots of theft and killing and stealing, and revolutions come out of that sort of thing too, and civil order breaks down. And that's how it's always been in history. When inflation destroys the economy, it destroys the nation's coherence and its solidarity, and it becomes highly disruptive. And it's time for some foreign invader to come in and pick up the pieces. Now, that's at the very least, we're in the stages of that ramp. Now, what that foreign nation would be to come in and pick up the pieces and so forth, you'd have to, it's your guess as good as mine. I kind of think that China is hoping it'll be their turn to come in and clean up all the debris in the U.S. when we destroy ourselves. I don't think that's going to happen, because China wouldn't really be capable of that unless we didn't help them. That's a reality too. Now, that fact alone brings us back to your question. Since we are helping this process of destabilization, since we are helping other countries to have an advantage over us, since we continue to send aid to our enemies and so forth, why do we do that? Now it gets really hard, because I think the answer is so clear that it should be obvious to everyone, but it's so hideous that people don't want to see it. Like looking at a terrible slaughter, you don't want to really see it. You turn your eyes away. What is the answer? The answer is that our nation has been in the hands of our enemy for a long time. Our leaders are not our leaders. They're our enemy. And they have a different view in mind. It's not America first. Even though if they say so in their campaigns, even if they say, you know, make America great again or something like that, they use that phrase and that patriotic theme just to keep the people supporting them. But their real goal is globalism. They want a one world government, and they don't want one nation, the United States or any other nation, to be superior in any way. They want to reduce the United States down to the common denominator level of all other third world, second world countries, so that there's no national culture anymore, no national pride, no invincible military force. They want the United Nations to be the total military force. They want this world government, which they intend to control. They will be at the top. And so in order to bring about this dream, which they have had for a long time, and I'm not making this up, because they talk about this dream. They write books on it. They give seminars on it. It's not a mystery at all. They called it the New World Order. It wasn't our word. And they want it to happen. And in order for that to happen, they have to destroy America. It's that simple. They have to destroy America in the name of helping America. It has to be, oh, it's for your good. We'll do this. We'll do that. So that's the hideous thing. So now we get back to the question, what's happening with inflation? Well, no longer are they even trying to slow down inflation. They're not, they just pulled the throttle on it. And they're making money, creating so much money out of nothing, out of debt. And they'll lend any money, amount of money to anybody, especially banks and especially other nations and large corporations. They just flood the money out there because they want to destroy the economic system. They want the dollar to totally collapse. For the first time in history, as far as I can tell, the leaders of a country have deliberately tried to destroy their own country. And that is what I see on the scene today. They're creating so much money so recklessly and giving it for anybody that wants it. Well, of course, their friends, but they're just flooding it out and they're giving it to all of our enemies and the people that couldn't give a hoot about us. And they're using it to fund their own regimes and build opposition to us. And so we see the rise of China and the rise of the BRICS countries and the rise of Russia and all these things. And we think it's wonderful. We go visit those people, send envoys, send them, you want some more money, you know? And meanwhile, they're trying to destroy the American independence. You can't even grow vegetables in your backyard anymore. I mean, there are laws against this. This stuff creates carbon dioxide, you know? And we got to fight global warming. So you can't grow stuff in your backyard. And you can't have cattle anymore because they leave methane out there or they eat too much of the natural resources. We've got global warming to worry about. You know, and they make this stuff up. And so what they're really doing is preventing people from having any independence of their own. They can't even grow their own food. They want them to be dependent on government paychecks to buy food. They want food coupons in everybody's future. They don't want you driving cars. They want you riding bicycles. And therefore, that's who do you think's putting all these bicycle lanes in? And there are no bicycles out of these lanes yet. But it's part of the long-range plan to get everybody off out of their cars. They'll tax cars, or they'll get rid of gasoline. They'll get rid of electrical systems for cars so that you don't have cars unless you're part of the elite. You know, then you'll have cars. It's all when you understand the master plan, everything fits and you begin to see the picture. So back to your question, and this is the horrible thing we don't want to look at, is we are being betrayed by our own leaders. And the fact that our system is crumbling is not because it's weak or bad or that the other nations are stronger. It's because we're being sabotaged from within. And until we wake up to that fact and do something about it, it's going to continue. And we will be, as Klaus Schwab says, we will have nothing and be happy.
Yeah, exactly. It made me think of all of the stuff that's going on in Davos and them wanting to spin out a digital currency and all of that nonsense. Two points, one point, and then one other question that I have for you. One point, I used to ask my father, and this was in the early 90s and late 80s when I was going up through the Cold War. And it seemed we would talk about propaganda a lot, and there's certainly a lot of propaganda now. And my question was, I mean, this just takes such a long time. The elites, it seems like they just have an incredible amount of patience almost to achieve this. And yeah, you comment about that. And then the last question I really have is, okay, so what is one to do? Obviously, I'm talking to you to get the word out, but what is one to do?
Okay, there are a couple of issues there. Is apparently this plan that I've been describing is a long-range plan, and certainly has. You can see the origins of it back over 100 years ago. It's certainly ramping up now, but all of the major elements were in place at least 100 years ago. And by the time Cecil Rhodes died and left his vast fortune to the creation of the Rhodes Scholarship and the Rhodes Secret Societies that he created, and we know about those because he wrote about them, and the executor of his state, William Stead, wrote about it. And so we know right from the horse's mouth what was done with these secret societies, which were so secret, Cecil Rhodes decided not to have a name for it. They even said, we won't have a name. That'll make it more difficult for people to talk about us. Pretty shrewd, pretty clever, actually. So anyway, It goes back by the time Cecil Rhodes was putting his thing together based on the ruins of the Illuminati, and he admitted he borrowed a lot of the stratagems from the Illuminati, from Adam Weishaupt. Talked about the, you know, how do you take over the world without the world even know you're doing it and so forth. He talked about those things. He talked about the rings within a conspiratorial organization, how a few people on the inside of a circle can control a larger ring around it, and that ring can control a larger ring and a larger ring. And so we talked about all those different levels of influence, ending up in the center with a secret society, which was his, and moving out to larger groups and eventually reaching political parties as the largest ring around all of this, which could be controlled by the inner ring. He wrote about all these things, but people don't read that stuff. And if they did, they say, I don't believe that. But it's the reality. So that, yeah, it's a long-range plan. It's kind of, at first, it's kind of hard to understand why people would have such a long-range plan. And it's the answer. I mean, it won't affect their lives in many cases. Those who started this off knew that they could never see the end of it. So why did they bother? And I thought about that a lot over the years. And it occurred to me either they felt that it was something very bigger than them, something that they felt allegiance to. It might have been their understanding of God or something like that, or their moral code. Or maybe they were truly true believers that it was necessary. As Lenin said, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin put it pretty well. He said, remember, you've got to break a few eggs if you want to have an omelet. And so that's an attitude. If you want to create a better world, you might have to kill a few million people. That's the omelet, you know, but it's worth it in the end. It's the greater good for the greater number in the long term. It could be that kind of a vision. It could be some kind of an occult affinity. Maybe the very top people belong to an occult, and there's some evidence for that. I'm not saying it is because I don't know, but I've often wondered about that, because they do show up in occult organizations a lot, and most of them usually flaunt occult symbols. You can see them with their fingers, you know, making sure that they do make these symbols known and so forth in public, and they get tattoos on their chest or their legs or someplace, and you can say, oh, there's the all-seeing eye. Wonder what that means. So you see a lot of that in there. So it makes you wonder, maybe there's an occult thing that transcends the individual. They maybe feel that they're worshiping Lucifer or something. I don't know about that. I'm not saying any of that's true. I'm just saying these are the only possibilities, because it's definite, it is a long-range plan. And now we come to the boys and girls today who were playing the game, and they seem to be in a hurry. Now that makes more sense. Because you want to see it in your lifetime. So that is not so hard to figure out. But when you look at that long-range picture, it gets to be kind of mysterious. We don't have to know the answer to that, by the way. We just have to know it's real. And we have to then come to your next question, which is, what the heck are we supposed to do about it? So that's a big topic. I wish we had not only a couple of hours, but a couple of days to talk about.
I can have you on again.
But I'd like to say that this is what I've devoted the rest of my life, whatever that amounts to try to deal with the answer to that question. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. It's probably obvious anyway, but I don't know the answer exactly in detail. But I do think I know the general structure of it. You don't have to know the details. You don't have to know exactly how to get to the mainland if you know that's that way, you know. If you're out at sea and you know it's the mainland is somewhere to the south, you don't have to know exactly where. As long as you get to land, you're happy. So I'm kind of taking that approach that I know the answer is over this way somewhere. But what is that? Well, I know that nothing is going to happen in the way of reform or getting rid of this evil thing that's upon us until more people are aware of it. Nothing will happen without that. You can't just overcome a power that itself has mastered control over the masses of the population. And that's it, because they'll direct the population against you. And I've noticed when I was learning about the rise of communism, country after country after country, the picture was always the same. When the the communist revolution first hit the country and they knocked these blocks out from under the existing government so that there was chaos and anarchy, they would go through the population and they would open the prisons, find the most violent criminals they could, and put them in the uniforms and give them guns and say, "You are now in charge of the police. Go do your thing." Well, they went out and got even score and they were told who to go kill. They just enjoyed it. There was no problem. And they'd go from house to house. And the idea was just to put terror into the hearts of the population. So they would go into their homes and huddle and shiver and shake and just wait. They wouldn't do anything. They're afraid to step out of their front door. So it's always been the same. They put the worst people in charge. They get rid of their obvious opposition, and then they go back. And it's an interesting fact I learned that the next round of people they want to pick off is not their obvious opposition, but the people, the do-gooders who helped them. Because they knew that these guys, they had their hearts in the right place, even though their minds were all screwed up. They fell for the propaganda. But once they realized that what they had done, they would be the strongest leaders against communism. And so they picked the people that helped them to power off next and shot them. And this was something I first brought to my attention when I got to have some long chats with Yuri Bezmenov, who is a Soviet KGB detective. He told me all about that strategy and why it was wise and necessary and unfortunate, he said. We consider it to be unfortunate, but he said it was necessary. That's how they think. So anyway, all of that, why am I going into that? I know why, is because it's important that we have influence over the masses. Now, the masses are not going to, I hate to use that phrase, but that's their word for it. The common people are not going to do very much. That's just not within them. They don't have the stomach for controversy. They don't want to spend a lot of time studying these things. They would rather just be told what to do. I hate that, but that's the way it really is. They'd rather watch something on television, like Dancing with the Stars, or watch a football game or something, which is total entertaining, rather than study history or find out what's really going on the political scene and who these people are, what's their background, and so that's boring to them. And we're not going to change that, unfortunately. But they still have to be reached and be made aware of the facts at some level. Otherwise, they can be motivated and turned against you. And they'll think you and I are the people that created all this problem. And they'll be given the guns and they'll come and get us. They'll say, "Yeah, you dirty capitalists, you fiends, you look what you did to our great country. I don't even have my baseball game to look at anymore."
Right.
So I'm trying to make this oversimplified, but we have to reach the large numbers of people to a point where they at least understand some basic facts. But our real goal is not to mobilize the large numbers of people, because they never can be, they never will be mobilized, but you do need their support. So who is mobilized? Okay, and we get to the gist of this. History has always been written by a very small percentage of the population. And that number, as I see it, from my vantage point, is about 1% or less. These would be the thought leaders, the people that stand up out of all alone and present an idea, a very controversial idea, and give the rationale for it, and everybody thinks they're crazy. But then they make a good case for it, and they'll attract another person. First thing, you know, you got 1% of the population who are not only aware of these things, but who have an idea for a change, and they go to work on it. They're not just advocates, they're workers. The 1% are the thought leaders. Now, the 3% is what they attract, and those are the workers. Those are the influencers, we tend to call them today. They're the influencers. 3% gather around the 1%, and they really start to make things happen. And then the 3% gather around them the total numbers of their total group is 15%, as I see it. And the other 70% doesn't even know anything's going on. Unless you take at the other end of the spectrum, there's another 15% working against you, and you've got these two sides organized somewhat similarly, but then you've got this 15% at one end, 15% at the other end, and 70% in the middle that They don't know what the heck's going on, but they'll go along with whoever wins. We saw that in the American Revolution. 15% motivated by 3%, following the 1% stimulated the revolution. And there were the other part of the population wanted no part of it. They said, maybe we should go to Canada so we don't have to participate, don't have to choose. And they were prepared to go along with Great Britain had the British won. But it was that 15% led by 15, inspired by one, that made the American Revolution. And that, as I see it, that's pretty much how it happens everywhere throughout history. So why not now? So what our real job is to find that 3% who will mobilize the 15%. That's a doable thing. In fact, in my view, we've already got those numbers. I think we've already attained those numbers, but the 15% doesn't know it yet. They still think they're alone. They think everybody else has gone crazy. I think it's more like 20% are totally awake. I mean, they know what's going on, but they think they're alone. So our job really is to mobilize that 15%, bring them together, get them away from their television sets, and get them out of their houses and go out to where the people are, meet people face to face. Don't go for this 15-minute city stuff. That's why they want us in our 15-minute cities and kept in front of our computer screen so we don't meet anybody and form coalitions with them. Our job now is to mobilize that 15%. Now, what do we do after we do that? Well, I have created something called the Red Pill University, which is a place of providing information and strategies for the very thing I'm talking about. That's for people who want to inquire. That's the 15% right there. They'll be at the university. And then within the university, we want to create campuses in every county in the United States. This will be groups anywhere from 6 to 60 people who really are what we might call boots on the ground. Our enemy has groups like that. They've got, you know, the Black Lives Matter. They've got the anti-fascist organization, supposedly.
Antifa's,
yeah. They've got all kinds of environmental groups and so forth. They're all funded by George Soros and by the federal government and the tax-exempt foundations and all that sort of stuff. But they're groups that are active at the local level. And this is how we have to build from the local level up. You can't build this movement from the top down. You just can't do it. And they didn't do it. They started into forming organizations at the local level. And we're already doing that. With a campus in every county, we will be able to turn this around. By that time, we'll control, literally, well, I say influence, to the point of control, overpowering influence over the county council, the board of supervisors, the boards of education, the sheriff's office, and eventually that'll filter up. All of a sudden, we'll have our congressional candidates who believe in the same things we do, who understand, not just stand up and say, I'm for the Constitution or something like that. It's easy to say those things. In fact, a lot of our controlled opposition leaders are very good at saying the right words. But we need people that we choose. You know, as we stand now, the elections are coming up, and we say, oh, well, who's running for office? Who am I going to support? Huh? Who's running? It's all over by that time. You choose between candidates that have been selected by somebody else. And guess who selected them? The same people that selected them.
Right.
Both parties and both candidates fighting each other are selected by the same person. Same group. They want the conflict, but they want to control both sides of it. So if you wait around and say, who's running? It's over. We have to determine who's running, and we have to generate the political support for those candidates. We have to build our movement from the bottom up. Now, how we translate that into legislation and reform, I don't know, but I know that we can't do it unless we have the organizational structure to make it happen. We'll find out when we get there, but our job today is to build the structure, to get the manpower in place, get the communications and the training and the knowledge in place, and we can do it.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Griffin, you are inspiring to me, but more than that, your message, the message is inspiring to me, and I could not agree more with you. It's also very encouraging of implementation. because that's what's frustrating. We can talk about it all we want, but if there's no North Star, I guess, and we don't know exactly what that looks like, but if there's nothing to go towards, what exactly does that mean? So it just, I can't tell you how much you've encouraged a young 50-year-old me.
That sounds young to me. That sounds very young.
And just for the children, for my children and hopefully grandchildren down the road. I'm going to put all of this, your contact info in the show notes and everything and links to you. But if you can all go ahead and give it a shout out, if anybody wants to join, can you communicate with you, or what's the best way to do that? What's the best means for you?
Well, we have a lot of websites. We have one website where we sell stuff, books and recordings, and that's realityzone.com. So if you want to check out some of the data that I've been talking about here, you'll find references and sources to illustrate the truth of everything I've said, and that's realityzone.com. And beyond that, we have nothing to sell but ideas. And the good place to start, I think, would be redpilluniversity.org. Once you get there, you'll be in the mainstream of the Red Pill Expo, which is put on once or twice a year. Our next one, by the way, is coming up in August of this year in South Dakota. And you get all the information there about what will happen at the Red Pill Expo. That's where people come together and meet face to face and learn that they're not alone. And
that's
really need that a lot.
Yeah.
And to get some very vital information, our speakers are absolutely tops. And I just talked the other day with David Bell. I don't know if that means anything to you, but David has unleashed a real bombshell. He's the guy that produced the little documentary and the book called The Great Taking. And he's unearthed the plan by which these international financiers are planning to literally steal all property that we think we own simply by having a crisis. They've already changed the UCC, the Universal Commercial Code, in every state of the union, and nobody knew it. He found that out. Every state has dutifully revised their UCC code to make what I just said possible, in fact, inevitable. And he has unearthed that, and his video and his book is going viral right now. He will be there and be talking about this thing. And so anyway, back to the track, which is the Red Pill University will get you in touch with redpillexpo.org. And if you really want to see what's going on at the think tank level, that's freedomforceinternational.org.
Of course, got it.
Yeah.
I will put all of this in the show notes. Again, thank you for your time. I'm, you don't know this, and we just met, but I'm a friend and an advocate. And I just want to thank you for the information, your time, and your encouragement.
Well, thank you, Andy. You make me feel good. You put a big grin on my face because, you know, the old saying, how does it go? Somebody said, what are you doing? I'm throwing these shellfish back into the ocean. Well, there's so many shellfish to throw back in the ocean. You'll never do it, make any difference. He said, well, no, there goes one. I love it when I see one just like you catch fire, because I know if that happens, there are a lot more ones out there.
There are. Well, thank you again.
All right. Thank you so much.
Have a great night.
Thank you. Same to you.